From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Every civilization eventually meets its demise, but some unwittingly hasten their own collapse. Our guest tonight, the environmentalist Professor Jared Diamond, says it was environmental short-sightedness that ended the 500-year-long ancient Maya civilization, and that America could meet the same fate. Can Americans learn from the mistakes of the Maya, or are we neglecting the warning signs? Tonight's On Point, destroying the environment and civilization. But we begin with more dismal economic news. The number of people looking for work has passed the 9 million mark for the first time in 10 years, according to a gloomy report released today by the Labour Department. Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I asked him why the unemployment numbers are still climbing.
Basically, we have two problems here, if you can call it that. One is the economy has been very weak or subdued by the standards of a normal recovery. Typically, after a recession, we'd be growing at about 4% a year at this point. Instead, we're growing at about 2%. We just don't have enough growth to create a lot of jobs. Now, another factor going on is that productivity seems to be a lot stronger today than it has been in previous business cycles, which is to say that companies have found ways to produce the same amount of goods and services with fewer workers. So even though sales are improving, they're getting by with fewer and fewer workers. Now, we're used to thinking of productivity as being a very good thing, which it is in the long run. That's why people's wages and standard of living go up over time. But at this particular juncture, high productivity growth is working very much against the creation of new jobs.
And is that the explanation for this phenomenon that we see where stock market prices go up even as unemployment figures go up?
No, the stock market is not going up because the job market has been weak. The stock market is going up because it thinks that 6 months from now, it won't be as weak as it is now. And remember, the stock market reflects where investors think things are going, not where they've been. So if you want to be optimistic, then trust in the forecasting acumen of the stock market. But as Paul Samuelson of MIT long ago remarked, the stock market has forecast 9 of the last 5 recessions and 12 of the last 4 recoveries.
If one looks at the rate at which the jobless figures are going up, from May to June, a 0.3 percentage point rise, that's bigger than in the past, recent past, isn't it?
Yes, Robin. The jump from 6.1% unemployment in May to 6.4% in June was a very large jump. But I wouldn't sort of take that as a sign that things are suddenly falling off a cliff. It probably reflects the statistical noise, the difficulties that the Labor Department has in getting a really, really clear, comprehensive picture from month to month. There had been a lot of skepticism among the economics profession that the unemployment rate really was as low as we'd been led to believe. I mean, they pointed out the fact that when they actually asked employers how many jobs they were creating, the figures were much more pessimistic than what they were getting when they would actually go out and ask households what their employment situation was. So in a sense, what we've had is kind of a catch-up between the two different sets of answers, the one we get from households and the one we get from employers. It now appears that the data we're getting from households tells us that, yes, indeed, the job situation is as dismal as the employers have been telling us for some time.
Let me just try and get some detail from you, Greg. In which sectors of the economy does it look as if the joblessness issue is most severe?
There's no question that the hardest hit place is manufacturing, the production of widgets, everything from cars to aircraft. We lost 56,000 jobs there in June. I think that we have lost jobs in manufacturing practically every single month for the last 3 years. That continues to be a very weak area. Other places of weakness are things such as a retail trade, perhaps not a good sign if we've been hoping for the consumer spending side to pick up. But there were a couple of little positive things. One of the more esoteric indicators you might want to look at is that employment at temporary staffing firms actually went up in June. Why is that a good sign? Well, the theory is that that's kind of a leading indicator. If you're getting ready to increase your output, you might want to hire temporary employees before you hire permanent employees, on the theory that if things don't actually work out, you can easily get rid of them again. So that's the second month in a row that temporary employment has gone up. If that continues, then maybe it actually does foreshadow an improvement a few months later on.
Are there any other indicators out there which give you some kind of a feel as to how things are going to go over the next few months?
There's a couple of other indicators, and the picture is very mixed at best. The Labor Department had another report out today, Friday, where they tallied up the number of people making their first claim for unemployment insurance benefits. That number went up to 430,000 last week. That was a very big increase, and it surprised a lot of people. It suggests that even as the month of July began, there has not been much improvement in the job situation. But there was another report today, and it went in the other direction. An organization called the Institute for Supply Management went around to a whole bunch of service companies and said, how are things looking? And lo and behold, they found a solid majority saying things are getting a lot better. So depending on what frame of mind you want, you can find good news or bad news.
So if you're somebody who's lost a job in the manufacturing sector, the answer seems to be go look for a job in the service sector.
Yeah. In fact, we in the Wall Street Journal had an article recently about people doing exactly that. I think we interviewed people who are working at factories and now are trying to get jobs as nursing aides on the theory that that's one job that cannot be exported to China.
What's the picture now on mortgages? Are people still remortgaging? Are they still changing their homes, moving upwards?
Well, Robin, one of the positive sides, if you could call it that, of the dismal economic news in recent months, as you no doubt know, is that interest rates have been dropping quite a lot on the theory that when the economy is weak, there's no inflation, so interest rates can go down. This brought down mortgage rates to the lowest since the 1960s and enabled a lot of people to refinance into a lower interest rate. However, in the last week or two, mortgage rates have started to move up again. There was disappointment that the Federal Reserve did not cut its short-term interest rate by more. There had been some positive economic news that got bond investors to rethink how high interest rates ultimately will be. And I think that if this move up in mortgage rates continues, then you will quickly bring the refinancing boom to an end. And I certainly hope that if that's the case, it will be because the economy is doing much better. Because if it's not doing much better, then we will lose a very important support for spending, which is to say both the housing market and the money people have been getting from refinancing their mortgages.
And is it also true that if people are worried about the possibility of losing their job, then that's going to make them more reluctant to take out new mortgages?
Well, you know, I think they actually will take out new mortgages, but what they do with the money will be different. Rather than taking the savings and plowing it into, say, a vacation or a renovation, they'll probably plow it into their savings, or they'll use it to pay their debt off faster. That's the kind of precautionary savings behavior you see when people become very worried.
A very mixed picture, in other words.
It is a very mixed picture.
Greg Ipp, thanks very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. The ancient Maya rose to the height of their power 1,200 years ago, establishing themselves as the most advanced civilization in the Western Hemisphere. But then, their civilization just disappeared. Their demise, says our guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jared Diamond, was largely due to environmental collapse. Today, he says, America faces a similar worry, that lack of foresight about the environment may effectively end civilization as we know it. Do you buy it? Is preserving the environment the key to preserving a civilization? And is America in a position to learn from the Maya's mistakes? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining me now from Los Angeles is Jared Diamond, Professor of Geography and Environmental Health Sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. His article in the June issue of Harper's Magazine is entitled The Last Americans, Environmental Collapse and the End of Civilization. Jared Diamond, thanks very much indeed for being with us tonight.
You are welcome. It's nice to be with you.
Let's start then by looking at the Mayas. They had a great civilization, then it collapsed. What did they do wrong?
Well, they did two things wrong, and something bad happened to them. The things that they did wrong were that they allowed population to increase unchecked, and they damaged their environment inadvertently, especially by deforestation leading to soil erosion and problems with water management. The other thing they did wrong is get caught up in a cycle of spiraling warfare. And the thing that happened to them was climate change, largely for reasons beyond their control, but a bit of it under their control in that their own deforestation led to a decrease in rainfall.
Okay, so what does that have to do with the way that America and Americans live today?
Well, two guesses. Just think of these issues. Increase of population, climate change, environmental impacts through deforestation, soil erosion. It all sounds very familiar, and it's going on, of course, not only in the United States today, but in other countries of the world, fragile countries, that particularly in the last dozen years have gotten into the bad habit of imploding themselves and causing problems for us that cause American troops to go in. So in short, these environmental and population problems are an issue for us not only at home, but because overseas they tend to create messes that affect us.
But does science, does technology, does not an increase in knowledge mean that we are now far better placed to deal with the kinds of problems which did for the Maya?
Well, an answer to that would be, everybody, look around you and form your own opinion. It's often said that technology will solve our problems, and the fact is that technology is morally neutral. That's to say, technology is simply power. Technology can either make problems worse or make problems better. If it were the case that through some magic bullet, we could reconfigure technology so that it didn't create any new problems and it only solved our present problems, then technology might make things better. But the cruel fact, of course, is that technology creates new problems at the same time as it's solving old problems.
It does, though, solve some old problems, doesn't it? I mean, for example, you can now feed more people off an acre of land than was the case 1,000 years ago. You can now irrigate land, you can fertilize land, you can genetically modify crops so that you get more yield. All that's a benefit, isn't it?
All that's true, yes, all that is a benefit. And despite that, today the majority of the world is living at below the poverty level, below even the minimum nutritional level. And the reasons are that while agricultural production per acre has gone up, human population has also gone up, so that the amount of food per person averaged over the world has not gone up.
Are you a doomsayer? Are you one of these people who are saying the end of the world is nigh?
No, I'm not a doomsayer. I'm neither an optimist nor am I a pessimist. I'm not saying the end of the world is nigh. I'm also not saying that everything's rosy and technology will solve all our problems. Instead, I'm somewhere in between. I'm saying that there are serious problems which are pretty obvious. And if we don't solve them, we'll be in a big mess, but that we do have a chance to solve them and carry on. So it's up for grabs.
Let's just look at one of the issues that you mentioned, population growth. Throughout the developed world, populations are either growing very slowly or actually contracting, aren't they? In some countries, certainly in Western Europe, I know, we're not even replacing ourselves anymore.
That's true, and here are some reasons why it's a little more complicated than that. It is true that the intrinsic population growth rate, that's to say births versus deaths, in the developing world is slowing down, and particularly in Western Europe and Japan, it's down below 1% per year. At the same time, it's also true that there is immigration, that people from poorer countries are moving to the richer countries where they're adopting the standards of living of the richer countries. And in addition, it's true that people in the third world are understandably doing their very best to attain first world living standards. But first world living standards mean putting out on the average 32 times more waste and consuming 32 times more resources than people in the third world. So what you've got to look at is not the number of people in the world. That in itself is not interesting. What you have to look at is the overall impact, and the impact of human population, of course, is growing steeply as everybody is aspiring to a higher standard of living.
This is, of course, a very complex issue. We're going to go into more of them a bit later on in the conversation. But just for now, just to give listeners a little peg to hang on to, what one thing do you say, what one lesson should they be learning right now from the Maya?
The one lesson that one should be learning now from the Maya is not to learn any single lesson from the Maya, but instead to recognize that in the modern world there are a dozen problems, all of which we've got to solve. And if we solve 11 of them and fail to solve the 12th problem, we're in deep trouble. So we should stop thinking of single bullet, single problem.
I don't know if we're going to be able to solve all the problems during the course of the show. We'll have a go. What we're talking about tonight is environmental collapse and the end of civilization. Do Americans have something to learn? learn from the mistakes of the ancient Maya. Is America destined to face a similar fate? Environmental collapse followed by the collapse of civilization? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about environmental collapse and the end of civilization. Do you buy Jared Diamond's argument that unless we look after our environment, our civilization could be doomed? Or do you think America is getting the balance right between short-term economic growth and long-term survival? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Jared Diamond, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. His piece in the June issue of Harper's Magazine is entitled The Last Americans, Environmental Collapse and the End of Civilization. Jared Diamond, let's just pick up where we left off and continue this conversation by looking at the issue of health improvements. Huge differences in life expectancy, in childhood mortality rates between the days of the Maya and the days of today.
That's true. Unfortunately, what you say is unequally distributed over the world. In the first world, yes, health and longevity are improving to the point where longevity in the United States today for Americans born at home is somewhere around 80, over 80 for women, close to that for men. In most of the world, though, probably more than half of the world, is in countries with short-term, much shorter longevity, in the 60s, 50s, even 40s. So the health gap around the world is increasing.
But is it not true that even in the developing world, where, as you say, life expectancy rates are far lower than they are in the developed world, even so, they are higher than they used to be?
In some countries that's true, and in some countries it's not true. Most spectacularly, in Russia in the last 15 years, longevity has started on a downwards spiral. What one can say, so as not to exaggerate the argument, is that probably the countries in the world that have the lowest longevity today have longevity comparable to what most humans had 10,000 years ago.
How does that work?
Oh, what it means is that most countries today have longevity higher than what longevity was 10 or 15,000 years ago. So that by and large, human health and longevity has increased.
Now, if people are living longer, if they are healthier, if fewer of their babies die within days or weeks of birth, does that mean then that societies and civilizations are better able to sustain themselves because they have a larger productive workforce and in time, women have fewer children?
In some cases that's true, and in some cases it's not true. There are societies with high longevities and very good health, notably Western Europe, Japan, and the United States, where what you say is true. There are also plenty of societies in the third world where a declining death rate and an increasing birth rate have led to a population explosion and a decline in standard of living. A spectacular example, one that I happen to have been reading about today, involves Rwanda and Burundi in Eastern Africa, countries where there was a population explosion, so that those countries still have the highest population densities in Africa. And the result was an actual decline in standard of living. Most people ended up below the starvation level, and the result in Rwanda in 1994 was one of the grimmest bouts of genocide in modern times that killed something like 15% of the population. So there's a case where increased population had an unhappy outcome.
You've chosen the Maya civilization as an example, as a way of warning people what could happen. If you had taken a different ancient civilization, let us say the Chinese or the Indians, Would you not perhaps have drawn somewhat different conclusions, because today we see a China and an India, both of which are economically flourishing, prosperous societies, with many people doing extremely well and living very good lives?
Absolutely, and that's a very important point. As you might have guessed, I'm in the middle of writing a book on the subject, and the book considers both the happy endings and the unhappy endings. Unhappy endings include the Maya, Anasazi in the U.S. Southwest, Easter Islanders, the Greenland Norse, all of whom ended up dead. And happy ending societies that carried on include China as India, and India, as you mentioned. Japan has gone on for 14,000 years without an environmental collapse. Pacific Islanders on the islands of Tikapia and Tonga and Java did rather well at solving their environmental problems. So when I say that we should learn from the past, we should learn not only from the unhappy endings, but we should also see what worked in the past and imitate it.
Could it be, then, that the Maya were simply unluckier than the people of India and China?
No, they were not unlucky. There were clear differences. The Maya had the misfortune to be in a more fragile environment, by and large, than India and China. There were also reasons having to do with the environment why the Maya never became politically unified, remained fragmented into dozens of city-states that were at perpetual war, whereas China got unified 221 BC, even before the rise of the Maya, and China's been politically unified most of the time from 221 BC until the present.
Let's take a call. Mary is on the line from Arlington, Massachusetts. Mary, hi.
Hi. Am I on the line?
You are. Go ahead.
Okay. I was responding to the comment that that I believe you put forward as an example of how technology is helping us and bringing us in a positive direction,
mm-hmm.
With the use of fertilizers and presumably pesticides and so on to increase crop yield,
right,
per acre.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to say that's a technique that really it's a short-term solution that leads to very, very bad results, because the combination of the fertilizers and pesticides kills the soil, so that the soil is then a dead thing that's completely dependent on the fertilizers and so on, which makes the fertilizer industry very happy. But the soil, as I say, is dead. It's dry, it blows away, it increases hugely the loss of topsoil. And the agribusiness solution is going to prove to be one of the deadliest things we're doing.
Okay, Mary, thanks for calling in. Jared Diamond, what do you say to that?
Yes, there's much substance to what Mary has said. In fact, when you raised the question before, I was tempted to say some of the things that Mary had said, but there's a limit how much I can say in 37 seconds. It is true that when one increases food production by various technological means, those technological means often turn out to have hidden costs, and that's true of fertilizers, Mary has mentioned. To what Mary has said, I would add that when you add fertilizer, the fertilizer usually ends up in the watershed, and then you get problems of eutrophication. And so, for example, in the central part of the Great Plains and the central Midwest today, for example, in Iowa, our great corn state, where lots of fertilizer is added, that fertilizer ends up in the Mississippi River, ends up out the mouth of the Mississippi River in the Gulf of Mexico, and big problems in the Gulf of Mexico from that accumulation of nutrients and eutrophication.
Heath is on the line from Butler, Pennsylvania. Heath, hi.
Hello there.
Hi, go ahead.
Professor Diamond, I'm actually reading your book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, right now, and it's tying in pretty well with my master's degree I'm studying for in sustainable agriculture. But I also have done some reading of Bill Mollison, who promotes ideas of permaculture. One thing he has said is easiest way to bring down to societies like the United States or Canada is buy futures in their wheat production. What do you say to something like that? We depend on our breadbaskets for our livelihood, and yet if we actually try to grow the wheat that we know we can, we're going to lose all our topsoil.
Yeah, two-edged sword, as you say. Wheat production is at the expense of our topsoil. That's a long-run problem, but it's a dramatic long-run problem. For example, a couple of years ago, I visited Iowa, and some friends took me out to an area, basically to wheat fields and corn fields, and it happened to be a place where there was a church, and there had been no agriculture, of course, in the graveyard of the church for about 150 years, but there had been agriculture outside the confines of the graveyard. And it was very striking that church and its graveyard were now about 12 feet above the level of the rest of the land, because there had been no soil erosion on the church and its graveyard, and there had been 12 feet of topsoil lost elsewhere.
Let me move away from agriculture for a second, Jared Diamond, and move the conversation onto education. I have heard many development economists say that the best way to encourage the poorer countries to become less poor is to educate their girls, because if they grow up to be educated women, then they first of all know more about health, they know more about how to keep their own children healthy, they also become productive economic units, they are able to add to the economic activity of their society, they also tend to have smaller families. Now, if all that is true, what impact does that have on your theory that that collapse could follow environmental disaster?
Well, there's much substance to what you say. I've also heard it said that whether or not it's the most effective, certainly a potent way of doing good, improving the situations of other countries, is to make an effort in women's education, and that's valuable for several reasons. It means women taking control of their reproductive destinies. It's an effective way of reducing the population increase rate. It's an effective way of getting women into the workforce. So this is really one of many things that countries in the third world can do and that some of them have done to improve their lots.
I don't know as much about the Maya as I should. Did they educate their women?
Well, we're not aware of any formal education system among the Maya. There aren't any signs of schools there. Maya writing, as far as we know, literacy, was rather limited, not just among women, but also among men, and was largely a vehicle of royal propaganda.
You mentioned war and conflict right at the beginning of this conversation. You said one of the mistakes that the Maya made was that they were warlike. They killed each other. Now, in many of the countries where there are currently serious problems, collapsed states, failed states. These are countries which have suffered years of conflict. Are you suggesting that there is a direct link between the fact of the conflict and the fact of environmental degradation?
You got it. And just to give you an example, let me now give you two lists of countries. First, let me give you a list of countries that are environmentally devastated today. Suppose you asked some ecologist friend of mine who's never come out of his or her academic study and doesn't read newspapers just to list some environmentally devastated, overpopulated countries. And that ecologist would say, no-brainer. Basket cases environmentally include Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Burundi, Haiti, Indonesia, Iraq, Nepal, Pakistan, Philippines, Rwanda, Solomon Islands, Somalia. And now let's take some person who reads the newspaper and doesn't care at all about the environment, but does know what countries have gotten into deep trouble or at risk of getting into deep trouble, and ask that person to name the list. And lo and behold, the list is Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Burundi, Haiti, Indonesia, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, it is true that countries that are environmentally devastated are more likely to decay into warfare and civil unrest and overthrow the government, because when people are starving and have no hope, they tend to be angry at their leaders and they kill each other in fights over limiting resources.
Just for the sake of argument, can you not turn that on its head and say it works the other way around, cause and effect, that where there is conflict, that results in environmental degradation rather than the other way around?
That's also true, of course, when there's conflict. That may either increase or decrease the environmental degradation. When there's conflict, for example, in Indonesia, where I do a lot of my field work, with the troubles in Indonesia in the last couple of years, the government has less attention to pay to national parks. So there is something of what you say. At the same time, one can look at the sequence of events, and it's clear both in the Maya case and also in the modern world that where you get more people hammering away at the environment, a result of that, as in Rwanda, is big messes.
Let's take another call. Dick is on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. Dick, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm interested about the issue of food and food supply. And isn't it true that, in fact, the way we use agricultural products by feeding so much of it through the animal kingdom before we eat it really greatly reduces the supply and, in fact, is part of the problem?
Yes, that is part of the problem. In particular, suppose you grow plant food. You can either eat the plant food yourself or you can feed the plant food to an animal and then eat the animal. But if you feed the plant food to an animal, you lose somewhere between 40 and 80% of the plant food. So as far as efficiency of human consumption is concerned, running plant food through animals does reduce the amount of food available to people.
Let's try and take this right back to a very basic level, Jared Diamond, if we can. You have a rural community in a developing country where people cut down forests in order to provide wood for fuel and wood with which to build their homes. Obviously, if they do that over a period of time and if the population grows too fast, then the woods and the forests disappear and we all know what happens then. How do you say to those people, don't cut down those trees, don't use that wood for fuel, you've got to find something else to do?
Interestingly, what's turned out to be the most effective way to, as you say it to those people is not to say it to them, but instead to pay for a few people in their village to go to some other village in their country where the forest has been chopped down. For example, my field work, a lot of it is in Papua New Guinea. I'm just back a month ago from Papua New Guinea. In Papua New Guinea, there are quite a few rural communities that were sufficiently desperate for money that they've sold logging rights to the loggers, and they've gotten a short-term cash flow, but they've ended up in a really sad situation because they've lost the forest from which they got their natural products and their building materials. And it's turned out that the most effective single way to persuade New Guinea villagers not to hamstring themselves is to pay for a few of them to go look at an area that has been logged, and they see the unhappy mess that they're getting into.
And they change their behavior accordingly?
Yes, they do. Well, in particular, they change their behavior in that they refuse the offers of contracts from the loggers.
Not directly applicable to the Maya, though, is it, that particular case?
No, because the Maya were in the past and they already made their mess.
And they didn't have anybody to go and look at and to learn from.
That is a big difference. And to go back to what you said about at the beginning about asking whether I'm a doomsdayer,
yeah.
The single thing that makes me most hopeful is what you and I are doing right now, the modern media. We are capable of learning from the past. So here you and I are talking about the Maya of 1,200 years ago, and we are capable of learning about what goes on in the modern world. So here we've been talking about Rwanda and other places, but the Maya had no way of understanding what messes had happened in the Fertile Crescent 2,000 years before that.
We're going to continue the conversation in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. Our guest is Jared Diamond. You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about environmental collapse and the end of civilization. Do you believe that it is environmental short-sightedness that leads to the demise of civilizations? Might American progress destroy American civilization? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Jared Diamond, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. His piece in the June issue of Harper's Magazine is entitled The Last Americans, Environmental Collapse and the End of Civilization. Regina's on the line from Hull in Massachusetts. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, yeah, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm very disturbed about the issue of the United States contamination, really, of the world as far as the environment is concerned. It seems as though the bottom line with anything that goes on in this country this day is how much money is someone going to make versus is it going to be good for our community?
You used the word contamination. What did you mean?
Well, I mean as far as the Environmental Protection Agency ended up putting out a report recently that was heavily censored by the government as regards our environmental status and what's good for it and what isn't good for it. But it seems as though any activity in this country that is geared toward renewable source or recycling is condemned because, of course, that is not the place where industry makes the money.
So, Regina, is there something you want to ask Jared Diamond then about that?
Well, yeah, I'd like to ask him what he thinks about the current status of the United States and the people who are here and living in the country and what he thinks they're willing to accommodate in this disposable world we have here.
Okay, well, let's see what he has to say about that. Jared Diamond?
A short answer would be, obviously, a mixed bag. Americans differ in what they are willing to do and what they consider important. And we Americans range over the whole spectrum from people who think that environmental issues are of no importance and people who are selfish and pursue their own interests entirely to, at the opposite extreme, people who are very concerned about environmental issues.
I have to say I am somewhat surprised that we've got to this point in the conversation without once having mentioned the internal combustion engine.
Well, the internal combustion engine is one of dozens and dozens of vehicles of environmental impact. It's interesting because it's very much in the news now, people making efforts to design new vehicles that reduce fuel consumption. For example, you know, I grew up in Boston. I was born in Boston and grew up there. And my last visit to Boston last fall, for the first time, I rode in a hybrid car. It was very interesting. I met a grade school classmate of mine, and she took me out for a drive in one of these remarkable hybrid cars, and it's very striking. You're at a start, you start moving, you don't hear a thing. Well, there's an example of thinking about technology, redesigning technology in ways that reduce environmental impact. And there are plenty of people, including my grade school classmate, who do care and will, in their choice of cars, want to get a car that reduces environmental impact.
Okay, we'll take another call. Brent is on the line from Acton, Massachusetts. Brent, good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
You're most welcome. Go ahead.
And I'd like to say to Jared Diamond that I'm a great admirer of his work. My comments and question, I wonder if Jared would say something about the difference between thinking about the standard of living and the quality of life. And the reason I think this is important is that this is such a big and scary issue that it's easy to feel depressed about it and wonder what can one individual do. And, of course, the individual consumption choices that we make can, of course, make a great difference. And reframing it as a quality of life rather than standard of living issue might be one way that individuals could make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Jared Diamond?
Two things I'd react to there. One is, yes, that is a good distinction between standard of living and quality of life. And the other thing, you've raised this key question of what can an individual do. It's tempting to feel helpless, to feel that one individual has no power compared to these multi-billion-dollar corporations that can steamroller us. But in fact, think of what an individual can do. First thing you can do is vote, because there have been elections, including some recent elections in the United States, that got decided by very small votes, elections between people who differed a good deal in their environmental policies. So you can vote. You can tell your friends to vote. You can clean up your own environment. You can be involved in neighborhood groups that are concerned with environmental issues and, at minimum, make things nicer for the area around you. And then if you've got some money, even small sums of money. You can devote money to organizations that are pursuing causes that you care a lot about. In particular, environmental organizations tend to be drastically overfunded, so a little money goes a long way.
Jared Diamond, everything that you have said to me leads me to believe that you very much would like people to behave in such a way as to enable this civilization, American civilization, to survive. Can I put it to you, though, that history teaches us that all civilizations sooner or later collapse, and that in that respect the American civilization can be no different to any others?
Fortunately, what you've said is not true. It's not true that all civilizations sooner or later collapse. There are civilizations that have gone on for a long time without any signs of collapse. I briefly mentioned a while ago that a prime example is Japan, where starting from the origins of complex societies and pottery in Japan 14,000 years ago, no sign whatsoever of an environmental collapse. Other places where there was not a collapse, the Inca Empire had a good reforestation program and was doing just fine until the Spaniards arrived. Or among Pacific islands, I mentioned Tikapia and Tonga. Germany in the last two centuries developed a very effective reforestation policy. So fortunately, it's not the case that all civilizations are doomed to collapse. Only some are, and we can learn from the differences between those that do and don't.
From what you know of American civilization, from what you know of how Americans behave and what Americans want, you call yourself an optimist?
Nope, I'm neither an optimist nor a pessimist, but I would say somewhere in the middle. My view is it's up for grabs, and my children, my 16-year-old twin children, are certainly going to see the outcome by the time they're my age, and maybe within a few decades, by the time I'm in my 80s, I'll see something of the outcome myself. I don't know what it's going to be.
Jared Diamond, thank you very much indeed for being with us tonight. Jared Diamond, Professor of Geography and Environmental Health Sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. And his article in the June issue of Harper's Magazine is entitled The Last Americans, Environmental Collapse, and the End of Civilization. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, the writer James Carroll reflects on America's mortality. This is On Point. As the United States blows out the 227 candles on her birthday cake tomorrow, there will be all the usual wishes for a bright future. The writer James Carroll has been thinking about the meaning of July 4th, and he finds that celebrating America's beginning also means confronting that someday this great republic too shall end. Here's James Carroll reading his column entitled Intimations of America's Mortality.
We celebrate beginnings, whether of persons or nations, as a way of honoring our place in time. The joyful rituals of July 4th, observed nowhere more happily than in Boston, remind us of the day on which our country came into being. This week we feast on summer food, listen to patriotic music, send up flares, and perhaps choke for a moment on the high emotion of love for this country. But to acknowledge that the United States of America has a beginning and is thus bound by the rules of time is implicitly to recall that this nation will equally have an end. What the 4th of July celebrates at bottom is American mortality. Like every birthday celebration, it defies the human temptation to imagine oneself as living forever. There is a time past when we did not exist. And there is a time future when, again, we will not exist. To remember the one is to anticipate the other. And everything America accomplishes and signifies must be measured finally against this radical transience within which it all occurs. What could be more obvious, you ask? And yet the truth of our national mortality eludes us. The ultimate demise of the United States is deeply unsettling, even if only in prospect. This is more true of our nation, perhaps, than of others, precisely because we define ourselves in terms more of the future than the past. the greatness of Britain or Greece is tied to what it was, which is why immigrants to those countries, not sharing the past, take on national identity with difficulty. American greatness is always tied to what the nation is becoming, which is why immigrants here feel readily commissioned to create that greatness. The American future belongs equally to everyone. But what if the future is finite, which is another way of asking about death? At Gettysburg, Lincoln suggested that our hallowed dead will not have died in vain. Only if, in the future, the great task remaining before us is accomplished. Lincoln thus gave voice to a basic American assumption that present experience is justified only by future outcomes. But if ever the Union perishes from the earth, will all those who died for it in the past have died in vain? In a world that remains bound by the rules of time and mortality, no matter how cloaked by patriotic fervor, is the characteristically American idea of boundlessness inevitably self-defeating? If America has defined the future as its only absolute, what happens when the future, too, is revealed as relative? This forward-looking ideology has been an engine of industry and social justice. But is it nevertheless built on a contradiction? And why shouldn't Americans have looked for ways to avoid the bite of such questions? Enter God. Here is the context in which to understand the use to which we have put our civic religion. When we claim to be a nation under God, and it was Lincoln who first used that phrase at Gettysburg, or when we blithely pray, God bless America, assuming that God's blessing for this country is unique, we are appropriating for ourselves divine attributes of infinity and immortality that, in fact, have no place on earth. And notice, we do this, 1863, 1954, 2001, when our future seems most at risk, the American variation on faith in foxholes. Thus, much more is at stake in our public appeals to God than constitutional questions about church and state. Every nation has a way of invoking the divinity, and every army goes into battle under the patronage of some god or other. Nothing new in that. But the American appeal is different because of the function God serves as a solution to the American problem. We yearn to think of ourselves as the indispensable nation, hoping to postpone the inevitable reckoning with an opposite truth for as long as we can. God is our postponement. On this earth, within the limits of time, no nation is indispensable. No nation is forever. When it comes to the human condition, no nation is exceptional. And if one nation is under God, it is only because every nation is. Therefore, the joy with which we celebrate our nation's beginning must inform equally a sense that our nation's eventual end marks us as part of the human family, which remains America's true glory.
James Carroll's op-ed column appears regularly in the Boston Globe. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.